Can you believe this is our last House of Frankenstein for this year?
I know, time really does fly.
Why do we have so many people stop by when we're trying to record?
I have no idea. Can I help you? Good evening. I am the coachman, or I mean the Uber driver.
Uber driver? We didn't call for an Uber.
I think you got the wrong house.
Not at all. I phoned him.
Why do you need an Uber?
I'm going out, of course.
Solomon Grundy going too. Yes, and we're joining them.
Oh, yes. I love riding in cars.
Wait. Grundy, Kane, and Abel are going too? Where could you all possibly be going?
We've got tickets to the hottest show in your mortal world.
Wait, don't tell me. You guys are...
Solomon Grundy and his friends are Swifties! Oh, for the love of... Well, have fun. Thanks for inviting us.
You're welcome.
Oh, yes. You're very welcome.
I was being sarcastic. Never mind, just go.
Wait, driver, don't I know you from somewhere?
I have that kind of face. No, I know you too. How come you're driving Uber? You try paying for a lease on an Abbey these days on account salary. This inflation is sucking me dry.
There's a creepy old house out in the hills, a domicile of weirdness, horror, and thrills, where you never have to wait in line. It's the House of Frankenstein. A strange couple there. Who are your hosts? They talk of comics and movies with monsters and ghosts. A peculiar place where the sun doesn't shine. It's the House of Frankenstein.
Hello and welcome to episode 108 of Supermates, the husband and wife geekcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Chris, and welcome to this year's final trip to the House of Frankenstein. Yes, we've reached the end of our horror journey for another year, but we saved our last episode for a film that is long overdue for discussion here on Supermates. It kicked off the Universal Horror Cycle and supernatural films here in the United States. So let's talk about the original Dracula from 1931, released February 14th, 1931.
Oh, a Valentine's Day.
Yeah, it was the strangest love story of all, as it was advertised.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which I don't really get that love story angle from this. Like,
Not this one.
Not this one. Later versions of Dracula, Langella, Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. Jack Palance, definitely, but not this one. Directed by Todd Browning and apparently Carl Freund, uncredited, which we'll get into. Written for the screen by Garrett Fort, based on the play by Hamilton Dean and John L. Balderston, which was, of course, based on the novel by Bram Stoker. In the cast, we had Bela Lugosi as Count Dracula, Helen Chandler as Mina Seward, David Manners as John Harker, Dwight Frye as Renfield, Edward Van Sloan as Professor Van Helsing, Herbert Bunston as Dr. Seward, Frances Dade as Lucy Western, Joan Standing as the maid, and Charles Gerard as Martin.
I am Dracula. A moment ago, I stumbled upon a most amazing phenomenon. Something so incredible, I mistrust my own judgment. Look.
Dracula. The very mention of the name brings to mind things so evil, so fantastic, so degrading. You wonder if it isn't all a dream, a nightmare.
Rats. Thousands. Millions of them.
But no, this is no dream. This is Dracula, the original terrifying story of a maniac. And a man who lived after death, lived on human blood, took the form of a vampire bat, and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Dracula? Oh, what's he done to you, dear? Tell me.
He came to me. He opened a vein in his arm. And he made me drink.
English real estate solicitor Renfield travels by coach through Transylvania on his way to Castle Dracula. The locals warn him not to continue on to the Borgo Pass on Walpurgis Night, a time where evil spirits abound. The innkeeper tells him that Dracula and his brides are all vampires and prey on the blood of the living. Renfield takes a crucifix from one of the women, but otherwise ignores their warnings. At Castle Dracula, the undead count and his brides arise when the sun sets.
Renfield meets Dracula's coach at the Borgo Pass, unaware the coachman is the Count himself and not an Uber driver. Flummoxed by the wild ride, including seeing a bat flying above the horses, apparently leading them to the castle, Renfield is shocked to meet his host in the crumbling battlements of his home. While the Count's peculiar nature continues to slightly unnerve Renfield, the two discuss Dracula's purchase of Carfax Abbey in Whitby, England. Renfield cuts himself on a paperclip, but is unaware of how Dracula is drawn to attack him over his dripping blood. The sight of the crucifix he was given repels the vampire. Dracula leaves, but returns as a bat, which startles Renfield and causes him to faint. Dracula's brides move in for their nightly feast, but their master drives them away, claiming Renfield for his own.
The two travel to England on the schooner Vista, and Renfield, now in Dracula's thrall, alerts his master when it is safe to awaken and hunt the ship's crew. When the Vista arrives in Whitby, all are dead except for the now mad Renfield, who is taken to the sanatorium of Dr. Seward. Dracula arrives in London and, after murdering a street vendor selling flowers, visits an opera. There, he announces his presence to Dr. Seward and his daughter Mina, her fiancé John Harker, and their friend Lucy Western. Lucy is mesmerized by the exotic count, both figuratively at first and then literally when he entrances her and enters her bedroom window, feeding on her blood. Lucy dies and Dr. Seward consults with his colleague, Dr. Abram Van Helsing. Van Helsing believes the attacks to be the work of a Nosferatu, or vampire, but the science-minded Seward has trouble reconciling the existence of such legends. Meanwhile, Renfield continually escapes his room at the sanitarium, chasing after insects, hoping to drink their blood and take their tiny lives.
Mina, too, falls victim to Dracula, who brazenly visits her while she is convalescing. It is then that Van Helsing notices the Count casts no reflection. He confronts Dracula with this, and the enraged revenant responds by smashing the box. Dracula leaves, and later a large wolf is seen running across the lawn. Despite his best efforts, Van Helsing cannot convince John of the danger Mina is in, even when Lucy seems to have risen as a vampire, preying on the young children. Dracula returns again, this time having Mina drink his blood, putting her fully in his control. He attempts to end Van Helsing's threat, but the strong-willed professor wards him off with a crucifix.
Dracula manages to abduct Mina while Van Helsing and John track Renfield to Carfax Abbey. There, through a window, they watch as Dracula confronts Renfield and punishes him for his betrayal by throwing him down the long stone steps, killing him. Dracula runs off into the crypt and Van Helsing and Harker eventually follow. Van Helsing finds Dracula's coffin and, making a makeshift stake out of the lid of the box, drives it into his heart. Mina is released from her vampiric spell, and her and John walk off to the sound of local church bells in the first rays of a new dawn.
Yes. Which, you know, that synopsis is fairly similar to several other Dracula movies we've covered over the years, but this is the first film, official film version of Dracula. So, Universal Studios founder and head Carl Laemmle considered adapting Bram Stoker's 1897 novel Dracula as far back as 1915, but the project proved to be too costly. Despite having huge success with The Phantom of the Opera, Laemmle wasn't too keen on horror pictures. His son Carl Jr., however, was very interested in them. In 1922, the German film Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror was released, featuring Max Schreck as the hideous Count Orlok. Despite the name change and the emphasis on the vampire spreading a plague via rats, the story was lifted straight from Stoker, and Bram's widow Florence was not happy. She sought legal action, and all prints of the film were ordered destroyed. Thankfully, a few survived. When Dracula was adapted into a Stoker-sanctioned London play by Hamilton Dean in 1924, the wheels began turning to officially bring the story to the screen. The play was a huge hit, and while many people played Dracula during its initial run, the primary actor was Raymond Huntley. When an American production was proposed, Huntley balked. So when the revised play, now updated by John L. Balderston, who also contributed to Universal's Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and The Mummy, came to America in 1927, they needed a new Dracula. Enter Bela Lugosi. Lugosi's good looks, natural charisma, and thick, exotic Hungarian accent added a sensual dimension to Dracula, which was missing from both the novel and previous actor portrayals. Lugosi's English was rough, and many of his early roles were learned phonetically. I had to stop myself from saying it like Homer Simpson. Phonetically. This added to the strange alien interpretation of the undead count, which women of the time found very appealing.
Mm.
Universal had a representative at the very first production of Dracula on Broadway and began negotiating for the rights. Despite the fact that he worked as an intermediary with the Stoker estate, Bela Lugosi was not the studio's first choice for Dracula. That would be the Man of a Thousand Faces, Lon Chaney. Chaney had made a huge impact at Universal, both as the Phantom of the Opera and Quasimodo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. He had also worked with director Todd Browning, who was shaping up to be the possible director of Dracula. The two had made London After Midnight for MGM, which featured Chaney as a vampire, sorta. In that now unfortunately lost film, Chaney was a detective posing as a vampire. But still, his makeup was iconic, so you know Chaney would have knocked it out of the park as a real vampire.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Chaney succumbed to throat cancer in 1930. Universal was apparently planning to lure him back from MGM, but no official offers were ever made. There's a lot of talk that he was cast as Dracula. He wasn't. They were just talking about wanting him to play Dracula. Director Todd Browning was apparently despondent over the loss of his friend and frequent collaborator, Chaney. This, combined with alcoholism, contributed to stories that David Manners and Dwight Fry told about how Browning wasn't very involved in the direction of this film and left much of the direction to a cinematographer, Carl Freund. Freund had been cinematographer on Fritz Lang's Metropolis and would later win an Oscar for that role for The Good Earth. He also directed Universal's The Mummy, starring Karloff, which is more or less a remake of Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
But Todd Browning was no slouch. In addition to London After Midnight, he directed Chaney in The Unknown, The Big City, West of Zanzibar, and Where East is East. After Dracula, the following year, he directed the controversial and disturbing Freaks, and in 1935, the remake of London After Midnight called Mark of the Vampire, starring Bela Lugosi.
There you go.
Lugosi campaigned hard for the role of Dracula. So hard he took a lower salary than a leading man should, only making $500 a week, compared to romantically David Manners' $2,000 a week.
Oh.
This unfortunately set a bad precedent for Lugosi's career in Hollywood.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Before we begin, we should address the elephant in the room. Now, this film is a certified classic. It begins the sound era for horror films in general, and Universal in particular. Lugosi is beyond iconic as Dracula, but the film is often maligned for being very stagey nowadays and harder to get into than contemporary films like Universal's Frankenstein, The Mummy, and The Invisible Man, etc., which all came out within 2 years of this.
Right.
Even more damning in that department is the existence of the Spanish language version, filmed simultaneously as the English language production, on the same sets, at night, but with an entirely different cast and crew. That version is much more moody and atmospheric, shows many of the scenes this film only talks about, and actually has some pretty convincing special effects for the time. Even though the runtime is longer, the Spanish version seems to move at a quicker clip. Carlos Villares is no Bela Lugosi, however.
No.
His faces he makes where he acts like he's smelling something bad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. Having said that, I still feel that the Spanish version is the better film, but I did enjoy watching the English language version again more than I have in previous recent times, beyond the obvious highlights of Lugosi, Dwight Fry, and other aspects we'll discuss. So we'll get that out of the way. That's one of the reasons why we haven't covered it yet. So,
well, and I mean, you, me, and the kids went and saw a double feature of Dracula, the English and the Spanish, and I was like, oh my Lord.
That was a bad move on whoever, I don't know if that was Fathom Events. I think it was Fathom Events.
I think so.
You know, for a cinephile and a horror purist, it was cool. But for even a fan like you, somebody that knows the history of the movies and everything, it's like I was talking to Brian Hyler about it yesterday. I was mentioning that And he said, it's like ordering a sub, and it's a good sub, and then you have to eat another sub. You know, that's kind of the same sub, but not the same, and you're not hungry anymore. You don't want another sub right after another one, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that. It's like, yeah, they should have, like, paired them, like, Dracula with Frankenstein, and then, like, the, you know, like, two double features, and then the Spanish with the Mummy or Bride or something.
Something.
Yeah, it was too much back-to-back. I mean, it was kind of cool to compare them, but... Even I was kind of like, you guys didn't even stay for all the Spanish one. You got up and walked out.
No, I'm just like, we'll figure out something to do.
Right, right, right.
I mean, poor little Danny. I mean, she was younger then, and I mean, oh.
Yeah, yeah. So back to this movie. We start off with the title card that has a stylized bat motif. And I wonder if Bob Kane ever put this down as an influence.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. The music is from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake for some reason, and Universal continued to use this in Murders in the Rue Morgue with Lugosi and Carl Freund's The Mummy with Karloff. There is no score to this film, and there have been attempts to give it a musical track, but I've never really liked any of them that I've heard myself.
Right.
At times, the lack of score and dialogue makes this seem like a silent film, and that's another criticism, that Browning wasn't really embracing talkies like other directors. You don't notice the lack of music much in Frankenstein, released later that same year. We start off with a real horse-drawn coach and some wonderful matte paintings making us think we're in the Carpathian Mountains. It's still very effective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It looks really good, yeah. The first line of dialogue in a talking horror picture is by Carla Lamley, a niece of Carl and cousin of Carl Jr.
Okay.
Yeah, and she actually, she's passed away since, but she hosts, like, the special features, one of the documentaries on the DVD set, Blu-ray set. She's reading about the castles, and the bumpy coach ride knocks her over into the other passengers. This is where we meet Renfield, who asks the driver to slow down, but some other occupants warn that they shouldn't do it, being Walpurgis night. Maybe stay home or don't travel on that night.
The one would think.
Yeah, that's what I think. We've mentioned Walpurgis night before when discussing other Dracula films. In the book and in Francis Ford Coppola's version, you see the blue flames later that Dracula gets out and follows. Saint Walpurgis is said to have banished evil, witches, etc. So I guess on that night the evil can come through easier.
I don't know.
I guess it's similar to some versions of Halloween, All Saints Day, and you know it's kind of a similar thing. Back to Renfield, he is played by Dwight Frye, who also played Fritz in Frankenstein and Carl in Bride of Frankenstein, as well as appearing in bit parts in other Universal horrors. Frye was an accomplished stage actor, but the parts of Renfield and later Fritz forever typecast him in Hollywood, despite showing some true range in the role here.
Yes.
He died a little over a decade later of a heart attack on his way home from a movie with his son. He was still a working actor, but he signed on to work at an aircraft factory for the war effort since he was deemed 4F and couldn't serve.
You know why he was deemed 4F?
I don't know. Probably bad heart. But he was a Christian scientist, apparently, and didn't you know, take care of his health problems.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so... Of course, Renfield is serving in the solicitor role Jonathan Harker had in the novel. In Stoker's work, Renfield is an inmate of the sanitarium, and Dracula's presence just agitates him. He doesn't have any prior history with him. And like in the Francis Ford Coppola version, they made him the previous guy.
Yes, that, who'd been there.
Who'd been there and come back, yeah. The people in the village warn Renfield not to go. The innkeeper doesn't beat around the bush like in many versions. He tells Renfield Dracula and his wives are vampires.
I know.
Yeah, I think I'd send in the papers by mail.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. Too bad they didn't have Zoom back then.
Exactly,
you know, just,
yeah.
And just email them over. The innkeeper, who goes uncredited despite his important dialogue, is played by Michael Visaroof, who also appears with Lugosi in Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the innkeeper's wife who gives Renfield the rosary with the crucifix. It's a good thing he keeps it, although I don't think we ever see him take it off, so more on that later. We then cut to Castle Dracula, which almost seems like an organic extension of the mountain. It's really well done and tells how ancient this place is. It's like slowly crumbling and like turning into part of the
environment. You would think that Renfield would be like, are we at the right place?
Well, he kind of is when he gets there, but yeah, yeah.
Is this place abandoned?
Right. Inside, the camera moves through the crypt, bringing us closer and closer to a coffin on the dirt floor. Our first shot of Dracula is actually Lugosi's hand, opening the lid slightly and grasping about. This is fitting since his strange hand gestures are a huge part of his characterization. We see a possum and a bug local to California known as a Jerusalem cricket. According to some sources, the possum was a stand-in for rats since they were seen as very unsavory and too shocking to show on screens to audiences at the time. So a bigger, you know, critter is okay. Yeah. And I don't know, man. Possums, I mean, we have a lot of possums around here. You know, and I mean, I know they're just, but they're, man, possums are ugly. I mean, you know, and they are.
They're like Kogo possums.
Well, I know, but I mean, we've had possums. I remember one time our dog was treed a possum out in the yard and just was sitting there barking at it. And I was like, well, what am I going to do with this thing? And it hissed at me, and I'm like, okay. I just went over and got a trash can and stuck it over top of it.
Yeah.
And our dog was like, where'd it go? And we got the dog inside, and I walked back outside and let it go.
And it was just like.
Yeah, it was like the Bride of Frankenstein, yeah.
See, that's why. You know?
There you go. Speaking of brides, one of Dracula's brides arises from her tomb, making her the first vampire we really fully see in this movie. She is played by Geraldine Dvorak, who frequently worked as a stand-in for Greta Garbo, who apparently she could mimic in both voice and movement in addition to resembling her.
I was like, wait a minute.
Is that Greta Garbo?
I was like, I've not heard of it. It was one of those cases. I'm like.
She opens the lid and says, I want to be left alone, and then closes it back. We see a possum digging in a slightly open casket with bones inside. A vampire who got staked, maybe?
I know, that's what I was wondering, you know.
Or maybe it was like somebody he brought in to, you know, change and never got around to it or something. I don't know. Then we get to actually see Bela Lugosi in all his strange glory as Dracula. Freund's camera moves in closer and closer as Lugosi stares straight at us and the audience, which likely was about to faint.
Mm-hmm.
I like how he has his cape wrapped around him. He's just a swath of black with a white head, basically. And his eyes are piercing, with Freund shining two small pin lights on them. He'll use that trick a lot in this film. It's a bit more subtle here, though, than it is later. But he's not actively hypnotizing anybody, either. We then see Dracula's other brides, played by the uncredited Cornelia Thal and Dorothy Tree. They are less glam than Little Miss Greta Garbo.
Right.
Yeah.
But she was a good one to open with.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We see Dracula climb the stairs out of the crypt. I never noticed in this scene he is wearing an Inverness cape or cloak with the extra layer of fabric from the shoulder to the elbow, like Barnabas Collins famously does.
Oh, okay.
He's got that kind of cape. We then transition to Dracula posing as the coachman. Lugosi keeps that same intense stare the whole time. In fact, I don't think we ever see Dracula blink in this film, at least not up close.
Right, right.
I think there might be an instance when he's walking to the opera that he blinks, you know, because it's on him for a while, and he's, you know, but when it's definitely, he's in a moment with somebody, he never blinks. Renfield's driver just throws his luggage off.
Yep.
Dracula isn't very talkative, I suppose, trying to keep Renfield from recognizing him later.
I would think so, to add to it.
At least he didn't put his cape over his face like he did in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein constantly, you know, so. All he has on is a wrap around his face and a top hat, though, so I think that's kind of interesting. The coach riding up the massive mountain road to Castle Dracula still holds up again.
It does.
It looks really good, yeah. Renfield sticks his head out to complain about the driver's speed, but sees a bat flying over the horses. Dracula is a very loud kind of sneaky in this film. Did you notice that? I mean, he almost seems to want to be caught and acts to alert people to his true nature.
I don't know if I just think it's that he has that much. You know, he's that full of himself, like, man, they can't catch me.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, he's like, he's kind of like, you know, it's just like, yeah, you know, like, look at this, you know. This film gets a lot of flack for static camera movements, but these opening scenes are full of fluid and pretty inventive camera shots. I mean, Fruin placed the camera low, below the carriage as it pulled into the castle, for instance.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you see that in a lot of Westerns and things later, but this is very early, you know, so. Of course, when they stop, the driver and his luggage are gone, and the large wooden door opens on its own, making probably Hollywood's first scary, creaky door sound. Yeah. The massive set of Dracula's castle foyer and stairwell is magnificent. I'm sure there's a lot of mad enhancement, but it reads completely real.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, it looks great. We see Dracula coming down the stairs, candelabra in hand, and then cut to the most curious inhabitants of Castle Dracula, armadillos.
That's also like, what?
These armored mammals are native to the Americas, not Europe. Apparently, they were included because it was once believed they dug into graves and ate cadavers.
Ew.
Yeah. Renfield continues to back up towards the stairs, not realizing Dracula is approaching as he descends them. Then he utters those immortal lines, I am Dracula. And the image and sound of a vampire are locked into the subconscious of an entire planet for all time.
Yes.
Renfield is polite, but he's basically saying, this place is such a dump, I thought I had to have been taken to the wrong place.
Yeah.
Despite this, Drak continues with, I bid you welcome. As Renfield follows him up the stairs, he utters his most famous line after a wolf howls.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
And Lugosi seems to really appreciate that howling sound, which says so much about his character.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a later character that he plays.
That's true, too. That's right. Renfield is looking out the window when he half notices that Dracula somehow walked through the massive spider web and didn't disturb it. Again, Dracula is playing a bit coy, but not really working at seeming normal, is he?
No. Yeah. Just like, I'm the dude, man.
That's right. Watch this. Yeah. He even smiles as he watches Renfield cut through the web with his cane. So, we see a large prop spider scurry, and Dracula says something that should send Renfield packing. The spider spinning his web for the unwary fly. The blood is the life, Mr. Renfield. I mean, run. Yeah. Run, dude, run. The door to Renfield's room closes on its own, but he doesn't notice. As Dracula shows him about. Dracula exits the room with Renfield's coat, hat, and cane, and the door opens on its own again.
Uh-huh.
Pay attention, dude. Also be concerned how he could have gotten your luggage off the coach so fast when you hopped out and it was gone. You know? I mean...
Right.
Another warning sign, Dracula asked if he kept his trip a secret. Now, why would it need to be a secret?
Right. I mean, doesn't somebody need to know where he's at if he goes missing?
Exactly. Renfield needs to develop spider sense or something, or common sense.
Mm-hmm.
My common sense is tingling, you know. So when Renfield pulls out the papers on Carfax Abbey, he notices Dracula's intense stare, and Freund is really laying on the light this time, but it's very effective.
Oh, yeah.
As is Bela's facial expression. I've seen some chalk up Lugosi's strangely stilted delivery as a language barrier, but I think if you watch his performance in total, this is all very intentional. Dracula is supposed to have this unnerving, otherworldly quality about him, especially in these scenes with Renfield. But still enough charm that you tend to forget it a few seconds after he's done something weird.
Yeah.
At least this Dracula. The novel version was basically a rather gross old man, you know. Renfield says he hopes he brought enough shipping labels, and Dracula, as he's looking over the lease, says, I'm taking with me only three... boxes. That's one of the few times Dracula uses less than perfect English, which I think is another reason to see this is all part of Lugosi's performance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he kind of lets his guard down there for a minute. I think he's kind of caught off guard there for a second. Several people who worked on the film thought Lugosi to be aloof and full of himself, walking around the set, working his cape and chanting, I am Dracula, over and over. Lugosi was a method actor before that was a thing. He was staying in character and developing how Dracula lived. He never breaks character, and it's one reason his performance is so magnetic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. When he tells Renfield he's chartered a ship and that we'll be leaving tomorrow evening, that's intentional. Lugosi is playing Dracula as intentionally messing with this guy and unnerving him, in my opinion.
Okay.
What do you think?
I mean, looking at it, you know, I think, again, he wants him on the back foot. I'm in charge here.
Right, right. I think so. Renfield cuts himself with a paper clip, and he doesn't notice Dracula being transfixed by the blood and approaching him. The crucifix just happens to drop over his hand, and Dracula recoils and covers his face. And Renfield thinks the sight of blood is making him sick,
mm-hmm.
which I think is funny. I have to say there's always been something about a young Bela that reminds me a bit of my grandfather. I think that's another reason I root for the guy, to a point. Now, tell me your story about the wine.
I honestly think, I mean, he gives Renfield wine, and he says it's a very old vintage.
Yeah.
And I tend to think that he has put some of his blood in the wine in order to control Renfield.
I never thought about that before, but I'd like to subscribe to your newsletter.
I mean, you know, just think about it. Then, you know, not long after that.
He gets, like, he's faint acting, like, ugh, you know. Yes. And he goes over and opens the window, and then he sees the bat. And I think then Dracula's the bat is basically, like, hypnotizing him to fate. It's not so much, oh, I saw the bat. It's like he's under the command of the bat.
But I really think he gave him some of the blood because, In a lot, you know, I read a lot of vampire fiction, and in a lot of that, and I think it comes from this movie, and I think other people have the same theory I do, you're given a small taste of the blood, not to turn you, but to put you in control, in their control. And when he says, it's a very old vintage, and the way the inflection he uses and everything else, that's my theory.
And of course, I like that theory. I like it. And of course, that's when Lugosi asks if he's going to drink, and he says, I never drink wine, you know.
So there's just enough pause that you're like, yeah, dude, I know.
Yeah. So, you know, Renfield opens the window. The bat comes in. He faints. And the bat work in this movie looks better than some of the later sequels, honestly. The bats are fairly convincing. And I didn't see any strings when we watched it on the Blu-ray. But I did see, like, one later when I was watching it on Amazon Prime, which I don't know if they've got, like, the cleanest copy. They might have like a DVD copy versus the Blu-ray copy, you know, and they may have cleaned up the lines in the Blu-ray. I don't know, but the bats themselves look more realistic than some of the later. It does, you know, some of them sometimes it looks like it they took a baseball, covered it with fur, and stuck some wings on it or something, you know. The brides move in to feast, but Dracula walks through the large windows out of the mist and motions them away. They recede off screen, and he slowly leans in to feed. It's not shown because apparently the studio was concerned with the gay subtext, but he's never shown biting women either.
Right.
So, but where's that crucifix now? I mean, you know, how is he able to bite him with it on? Did it, you know, maybe it fell behind him, you know, it's underneath him while he's laying there? Or...
Well, but you also have to think this is while he's in his, to me, in his thrall. He might have just taken it off and it wasn't shown.
Yeah, I guess, but yeah. Then we transition to stock footage from a 1925 silent film from Universal called The Stormbreaker. The frame rate is different, so the footage looks sped up. This is meant to represent the Vesta, the ship taking Dracula and Renfield to England. In the book, as in the recent film that came out, it's the Demeter.
See, I want to see that movie at some point.
I do too. I didn't get around to it. It kind of came and went. You know, I did see Renfield, which you guys need to watch that. I've seen it, and I did enjoy it. And of course, they recreate some of the scenes from this movie with Nicolas Cage and Nicholas Holt in that film. And it's a fun movie. I mean, you can't quite like say that it's quite Dwight Fry's Renfield, but it works. You know, it works. It's fun. It's a fun movie. We jump to Renfield calling Dracula master and letting him free from his locked coffin box when the sun is down. I wonder if audiences were a bit confused by this. It's very abrupt. You know, I mean, because if you don't know the story of Dracula, like, why is this guy working for Dracula now? Renfield asks if he'll keep his promise about giving him small inhuman lives with blood in them when they arrive in London, and Dracula just glowers at him. Sets up their new relationship right away.
Oh, yeah. It's like, dude, I own you.
Mm-hmm. We just see Dracula standing outside of the door of the cargo hold, observing the sailors trying to fight the storm. Then another long shot of the boat, which is obviously a model, but it's still pretty effective. I mean, the next shots are very effective. The large post on a dock, as we hear voices talking about the shipwreck. Then the shadow of the captain tied to a wheel, his body frozen in death. Renfield tells Dracula's coffin that they've arrived, then locks it back. So I guess he just finished it. He just finished up right before they came in to shore, I guess. The unseen authorities hear Renfield's strange laughter, open the hatch, and see him at the bottom of the stairs smiling. This is Fry's most iconic scene. And they say, why, he's mad. The man's gone crazy. Fry's son said his father would often be greeted by people imitating that frozen grin and laugh when they recognized him.
Can you imagine that?
You know, that thing, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that'd be kind of like, yeah, dude, I get it. I want to buy a sandwich. You don't have to do that, you know, to me right now. We talked about Claude Rains' Invisible Man, how it influenced Mark Hamill's Joker, but I feel there may be a bit of Fry in his Joker.
Oh,
and,
definitely.
And I think there's I've always thought Mark Hamill and Dwight Fry kind of have a resemblance to each other.
I can see
even
that.
Their voice is kind of similar in some ways. Yeah. Yeah. So Dwight Fry is Luke Skywalker. Who knew? A close up of a newspaper fills in that all hands were found dead and that sole survivor Renfield, who wants to eat flies, ants, etc., was taken to Dr. Seward's sanitarium near London. There's some geographic tomfoolery going on here. Because Whitby is on the Yorkshire coast in northern England, and London, they aren't anywhere near each other, really.
No.
So, yeah. We then shift to London, and we learn for the first time, for certain, this film is set in then-modern times. This is 1931, not 1897, because we have contemporary automobiles.
Right.
Now, we did have an automobile, an early automobile, in the Frank Langella Dracula that Harker had.
Uh-huh.
But that was set in the early 1912 or something like that.
I believe so.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. Dracula encounters a young lady selling flowers, and we get our first hint of sexual overtones with the vampire in his bite. He stares at her with the light on his eyes, of course, and she is very transfixed.
Oh, yeah.
Then he moves her behind the wall that is in the foreground, and we hear her scream. Anita Harder plays a flower girl, and I don't know, but I find her more interesting in those few seconds. She's got kind of that haunted look. I find her more interesting than Lucy, who we'll meet in just a few minutes.
I wish they'd switch the roles.
Yeah, I mean, Lucy just seems like she's very, like, she's almost like walked in from a flapper role from a, you know, I know we're after, actually kind of out of the flapper era, but she, I don't know. I mean, Helen Chandler has kind of that same kind of haunted kind of look about her, but I don't really get that with Lucy. Can you imagine seeing this girl walking later through the cemetery?
Right.
I think she'd been much spookier.
Sold it, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Dracula's seen walking confidently through the streets of London like he just had a great meal. He's looking very dapper in his top hat. It should be noted that Dracula wears variations on his evening wear throughout this film, and this is why NECA has switched up the sculpts of their 7-inch color and black and white Dracula figures,
mm-hmm.
which I bought the black and white one. I haven't found the color one yet. I found the black and white one at a show cheaper than normal, so I bought it. But I need to get the color one. But since he wears black and white tuxes, you can just take the different color heads and like pop them on and have
right.
different outfits for a colored Dracula. So he goes into an opera with the London Symphony Orchestra. And I love how he smirks as he looks around before entering. He's loving being able to mingle with his meals.
I think I'll have that for lunch and that for supper. Yeah. That'll be my after dinner mint.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the whole point of Dracula in the book and most versions coming to England is to, you know, his country is dead, and they're all scared of him. They all know how to stay away from him. Basically, it's harder for him to hunt there.
Right.
If he's in new and you know, a bustling metropolis, you know, it's an all you can eat buffet.
Yeah.
You know, basically. Dracula hypnotizes an attendant into taking him to the box containing Dr. Seward, his daughter Mina, her fiance John, and their friend Lucy. So, how did Dracula know they'd be there? Was Renfield already sending him intel, you think?
Or it might just be that everybody that's anybody's at this play tonight.
Mm. It's like a Taylor Swift concert.
Yeah.
The attendant tells Seward he has a phone call, and as he gets up, Dracula enters. And he introduces himself, and we properly meet the majority of our main cast. Dr. Seward is played by Herbert Munston, also known for Moonstone, The Last of Mrs. Chesney, Vanity Fair, and The Monkey's Paw. So another horror there. Mina, who is Seward's daughter in this version, is played by Helen Chandler. She is also known for Outward Bound, Dance Hall Hostess, and Goodbye Again. John Harker is played by David Manners, who appeared in Journey's End, directed by James Whale, which we mentioned in our Invisible Man episode. He'll go on to appear in two more Universal horror films, The Mummy and The Black Cat. The later is with Lugosi, who he also worked together with on The Death Kiss. He and Chandler had appeared together several times in films such as Mother's Cry, so they'd worked together before. Frances Dade plays Lucy, whose surname is slightly changed to Western instead of Westerner. Dade played in Grumpy, Raffles, and Daughter of the Dragon. Strangely, all three of the younger leads would be out of Hollywood pictures by the end of the decade, and Bunston would die in 1935 of a heart attack.
That's weird.
Yeah, so these, you know, they, despite the fact that they're in this big movie, they, you know, the younger leads don't really continue on too long afterwards. And Drac is slick. You know, he's like, pardon, I could not help overhearing your name. We're neighbors, you know,
yeah.
Basically. You know, it's like, yeah, he tells him he bought Carfax a heavy and everything. Seward goes off to answer the fake phone call, and Dracula begins discussing his plans for the Abbey with the younger folk. He tells him he doesn't plan to do any renovations since it reminds him of his castle in Transylvania. Lucy shows she's the goth chick of the group, quoting an old poem about death.
Yeah.
And again, Dracula isn't trying real hard to conceal his innate strangeness. He says, to die, to be really dead, that must be glorious. And Mina is shocked, but he continues, there are far worse things awaiting man than death. And there's a great transition as the music resumes, and it's very ominous. It does make you wish there was a true soundtrack at times.
Yes.
Yeah. Then we cut to Mina and Lucy's sleepover, and Helen Chandler becomes the first person to mock or mimic Lugosi's Dracula, reciting his speech about his old castle battlements in his accent. So, you know.
Yeah.
While they talk, but she doesn't go blah, blah, blah.
No.
Yeah. While they talk, there's a shadow from a lamp that looks rather bat-like, but it's probably just a coincidence. It's just something I noticed. Lucy is into Dracula.
I know.
I mean, daydreaming about him, his castle, being a count. Mina is all about John for some reason. Mina calls her Countess and bids her good night, which I think is funny. They got like, you know, there is a little bit of a playful dynamic between the two. We see Dracula walking the streets of London, and then Lucy opening her windows, and then he's outside her window. So did he command her to open them, do you think? Is she inviting him in even under the influence?
I don't know
if it, like, they don't really go into that he has to be invited in here, but that's, you know, that's a rule sometimes. So she gets ready for bed, and Dracula in bat form floats outside her window. I think Freund used his light trick on the bat's eyes because they kind of sparkle, which works. He hypnotizes her to sleep. Then we cut from her in bed to Dracula standing in her room, staring at her. He moves closer and leans in for the bite. This seems chaste now, but I'm sure it was somewhat scandalous back in 1931.
Yes.
It's like, oh, she's in her knickers, you know. We then fade to an operating auditorium, and Lucy is dead.
I know, just boom.
The attending surgeon notes the loss of blood, the two marks on her neck, and the failure of the transfusions to save her. So unlike most adaptations, there isn't any repeated visits to Lucy and her growing weaker. Dracula must have drained her dry in one night.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's like, and we'll get more of a, you know, the truncated Lucy storyline later. We're then following some nice crane shots and tracking camera into Seward Sanitarium. We hear Renfield pleading with Martin not to take his spider away from him. Martin is the comedy relief orderly with the thick Cockney accent, who could have come straight out of a James Whale film, proving those stereotypes existed before he made them popular.
Yeah.
He's played by Charles Gerard, who was also in Journey's End, as well as the Laurel and Hardy film Another Fine Mess. Him and Fry have a nice rapport going back and forth about not wanting flies when he can have spiders. Not sure he's helping the patients much by calling him loony.
No.
Oh, he's loony. You know, just, oh, he's crazy. Over and over through the movie.
Yeah.
HR, man. They're going to have a problem with that guy.
Uh-huh.
Then suddenly, Professor Van Helsing.
Yes.
Seward is consulting with him in an unnamed and uncredited group of scientists, and Van Helsing breaks down that they are dealing with a vampire. I'm guessing Seward traveled to Austria to meet with Van Helsing because the other men are speaking in German at times, and they call the vampires Nosferatu.
Yeah.
We don't really know for sure, but we later hear that he's come back from somewhere. Van Helsing is played by Edward Van Sloan, who, like Lugosi and Fry, came over from the Broadway production. Van Sloan was somewhat of the backbone of the early Universal horror films, appearing in this, Frankenstein, and The Mummy, and reprising the Van Helsing role in Dracula's Daughter, the direct sequel to this film. Then we fade and we're in Seward's office. There's some serious jumping between events and locales.
Yes, it's very, you know.
Yeah, it's very choppy at times. This may be a result of a frustrated and apparently disinterested Browning supposedly ripping whole pages out of the script because he felt they weren't necessary. This is one reason the Spanish version runs longer, as it actually followed the script much closer. Yeah, follow the script, guys.
Yeah.
So they're talking about Renfield and how he escapes, and they aren't sure where he goes. Who's letting him escape?
I know, right?
Put him in a straitjacket.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I know they threaten him with that later. Why don't you do it? I mean, heck, you know, think about Tom Waits and Bram Stoker's Dracula. He's like got the straitjacket with it like tied to the walls, and then
Basta.
chewing the rubber room in that film. Martin brings Renfield in, and he vacillates between being friendly to defiant. He begs Seward to send him away, or his ravings may give Miss Mina bad dreams. So clearly Dracula has either told Renfield he's going after Mina, or their connection is a bit of a two-way street.
Yes.
I don't know which, but I don't really know if Dracula would say, well, I mean, he hasn't told him, but he's like mentally told him, you know. The sun sets, a wolf howls, and we cut to the crypt of Carfax Abbey. Dracula comes out of his coffin box in a fairly unspectacular fashion. The lid starts to open, the camera pulls toward the window for another wolf howl, and then back as Dracula is standing, raising his head. The Spanish version used fog and some nice dissolves to make it seem like Dracula rose as a mist.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, points for the Spanish version where that's concerned. Martin tells Seward and Van Helsing that Renfield talks back to the Howling Wolves, and Van Helsing knows that Renfield is connected to Dracula, or to the vampire.
Yes.
He pulls out some wolfsbane, and Renfield pulls back. Interesting that it's wolfsbane here and not garlic. I like Renfield's line almost as if it comes from Dracula. You know too much to live, Van Helsing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I like that. Because we'll get kind of a similar line later from Dracula. Before Martin takes him out, Renfield warns them again, if they don't send him away, they will be responsible for what happens to Mina. Listen to this guy.
Yes.
Send her away just to be on the safe side.
Right.
I mean, why not say, you know, why don't you go run off, you know, go take a vacation somewhere.
Yeah.
You and John, because he's useless. So, you know. We cut to Renfield in his room crying, and then he hears the wolf, and Dracula is outside his window. He says nothing, but apparently tells Renfield to do something regarding Mina, but I'm not sure what it is.
I know.
I mean, Renfield is begging him not to ask that and not to involve him in hurting her, but I can't figure out what he actually does here. We then cut to Mina, and she's asleep in her bed, and she has what appears to be wolfbane on her neck, so I don't know if they, like, took that from a later scene and just, like, inserted it, because later she's supposed to have wolfbane
right
on her around her neck. Dracula appears as a bat at her open window, then in his normal form inside, near her bed, and comes in on her. So the wolfbane, maybe it's not supposed to be there now. It doesn't repel him. And so did Renfield open the window?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's the one thing I can figure. While this scene has a great close-up of Dracula as he's about to attack, it's surprising for many to see Dracula is never seen with fangs. And Lugosi never wore them while playing the character.
Right.
So, we really didn't get vampire fangs until there was a Spanish, Mexican film called El Vampiro, and then, of course, Hammer's Horror Dracula. There's a pretty big goof in this scene, too, though. As Dracula approaches Mina's bed, the lamp on her table has a big piece of stiff paper attached to it, like cardboard, probably to block some light in a different shot, but it's kept on there in this scene.
Right. They didn't catch it.
It's huge, too. I mean, it's like, it almost blocks out, like, Dracula's hand as he's coming by. The next day, Mina, wearing a scarf, never a good sign, is telling John about her strange dreams. She describes two red eyes and a white, livid face, which matches a lot of later color depictions of Dracula.
Yeah.
Van Helsing overhears it and starts questioning her. He asks if anything could have brought this dream on. Oh, I don't know, the fact that your best friend died mysteriously of blood loss, like several other people in the area.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody just kind of just forgets that Lucy's dead until later, then they forget it again. There's a nice bit where they notice the wounds on her neck, and John asks, what could have caused them, Professor? The next line is delivered by the maid announcing, Count Dracula. I like
yep.
that. Yeah, it's like as if an answer. The maid is played by Moon Carroll, who was also in The Last of Mrs. Chesney. Dracula tells Stuart it's good to see him back, pointing to him being out of town as we suspected. And Mina looks at Dracula very longingly. She may not know it, but clearly she's under his spell already at this point.
Uh-huh.
It's subtle, but Chandler does a good job of portraying it. According to several people who worked on the film, Chandler thought of herself as a big star in the making and felt this movie would make her career. Despite its popularity, she didn't achieve the level of fame she felt she deserved.
Well.
Yeah, so apparently she was very, you know, thought she was the next big thing. Seward introduces Van Helsing, and immediately these two are sizing each other up. I like that. Dracula slyly says they know of him, even in the wilds of Transylvania. He's probably killed off some of his friends or acolytes.
Yep.
Dracula apologizes for the grim tales he told of Transylvania may have caused Mina's bad dreams. So Dracula's apparently been calling on Mina during the day, too.
Uh-huh.
Which I think is interesting. And John isn't too happy about it, which you can understand.
Yeah, that's his woman.
And I think this is as close to true emotion as we get from David Manners in this film. I know he's in a lot of Universal horror films, but I've never been a big fan of him. He always seems like he's just like reading lines and not actually invested in his role very much. He even was quoted as saying he and Chandler didn't take the material of this film seriously. And I think it shows for most of the film.
And yet he got paid four times as much as Lugosi.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, am I being harsh or do you get that?
No, I mean, he doesn't really add. I mean, he's there.
I mean, I think of somebody like, I mean, obviously Frederick March was a great actor. I mean, you know, but somebody like him that was like around the same age and, you know, similar build and kind of same look, you know, think of what somebody like him could have done in this role, you know. But John gets huffy, opens up the cigarette box, and that's when Van Helsing realizes Dracula isn't reflected in the mirror in the top of the lid.
Mm-hmm.
Van Helsing tells Mina she had better go off to bed. Her father agrees, and she argues until Dracula says she'd better do as her father advises. And that's another subtle bit of showing his control over her.
Yes.
At this time. Dracula asks if he may call later and inquire how you are feeling. Of course, she agrees, so was he asking for that formal invitation again?
Oh, that's...
either way, it's pretty ballsy considering what he's really doing and the fact that she has a fiancé.
I know. I mean, hey, can I come check on you later? I mean, I know you got a boo, but you know.
Even with his ridiculous short pants he has on in this scene.
Yeah.
I know it was the style at the time, but man, those things are dopey looking. Then we get one of the more famous scenes in the film. Van Helsing asks for Dracula's help, and he steps over to him. He tells him how he stumbled upon a most amazing phenomenon. He tells him to look inside the box, and when Dracula sees the mirror, he strikes it out of his hand, backs away, and just glowers at him.
I mean, way to tip your hand, dude.
Yeah. In the Spanish version, Carlos Villares smashes it with his cane, but despite the improved spectacle, you can't beat Lugosi's slow facial change from murderous rage to simmering hatred to scheming a possible cover-up in an exit. He briefly looks ashamed that he lost his cool, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He apologizes to Seward, simply saying, "I dislike mirrors. Van Helsing will explain." So he's not even going to try and cover it up, because he knows Van Helsing is going to tell them he's the vampire.
Yeah.
He just, like, exits. But he gets one hell of a lot exit line as he leaves. "For one who has not lived even a single lifetime, you're a wise man, Van Helsing."
Yeah.
That's great. After that great scene, I do feel like the movie gets a bit phoned in and really reverts to the stage play look that people criticize it for. For one, there's a lot of tell, don't show going on. We get that as Jonathan follows Dracula to the terrace, and he says he sees a large dog running across the lawn. Clearly, Dracula has turned into a wolf, but they aren't going to bother showing it.
No.
Sure, they probably would have used a German Shepherd, but still, we should have saw something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even in the shadow.
The silhouette, so. Yeah.
Yeah. Van Helsing explains his theories on Dracula and Seward, and especially John have a hard time believing it. Van Helsing explains the strength of the vampire is that people will not believe in him. And I like that. But Dracula is really doing a lousy job hiding it. And I think, again, it's on purpose because he's partially flaunting it.
Yes.
Like you said, he's very cocky about it. While they are arguing, Mina walks out of the house onto the lawn and meets Dracula beneath the trees. And she looks very happy to do so. But the image of him putting his cape around her as they begin to embrace is very well done.
Yes.
I like that, yeah. It's like he's literally enveloping her, you know, in his world. Back inside, Van Helsing is giving them a crash course in Vampire 101, and we're not going to go over the details. You know the drill, sunset to sundown, native soul. He must have brought boxes of it with him, blah, blah, blah. They hear Renfield laughing, and he walks in, telling them to be guided by what Van Helsing says. So this version of Renfield is really trying to break through and help them out, which I think is a stronger way to go with him than just Mad Stooge. Mm-hmm. Dracula appears in bat form at the window to admonish Renfield for his portrayal, and he tells him, "No, master, I wasn't going to say anything." He's not only a snitch, but a lying snitch.
Uh-huh. So,
Van Helsing asks what he has to do with Dracula, and Dwight Frye's reaction is great. He loudly asks, "Dracula!" And he grabs his chest, looks away, and slowly straightens up and continues, "I never even heard that name before." So, I really think Dwight Frye's like, you know, he's the icing on the cake, you know, mm-hmm. of the Lugosi cake in this. Van Helsing tells him he'll die with innocent blood on his soul, but Renfield says, "God will not damn a lunatic soul. He knows the powers of evil are too great for those of us with weak minds." And he's sobbing as he says this, and you really feel for this poor bastard.
Right.
I mean, you really do. The maid runs in to tell them that Mina is out on the lawn dead. The men run out, and Renfield starts his low, guttural laugh again. She faints, which I know you love.
Ugh.
Yeah. But she did just see what she thought was a dead body. You know, so, I mean, you know. But how ballsy was it for Dracula to victimize Mina right after he'd been exposed?
Yeah, true.
I mean, you know. Renfield crawls over to the prone maid, and many people have assumed this was a vampiric or maybe even sexual thing, but apparently he was really after a fly that was on her, and this was cut. It's shown in the Spanish version.
Okay.
That he catches the fly that's on her, or a spider, or it's a bug or something. The men find Mina, and of course she's still alive, but as they are frantically carrying her into the house, Dracula is observing from behind a tree. Again, ballsy.
Uh-huh.
I'm surprised he didn't just go in and murder the whole sanitarium. What could have stopped him at this point?
Exactly, you know?
It's just... Ugh. We then cut to probably the eeriest scene in the film. Police Bobby rides his bicycle up to a cemetery where he hears a child crying. Then we see Lucy walking through the trees. This is followed up by Martin reading the newspaper account of several attacks on small children by the woman in white.
I mean, I like this version, but I honestly think that it's done better in the Langella version.
Oh, God.
You know, I was like, whoa.
Oh, my God, yeah. Woo, yeah. They switched Mina and Lucy's names, but yeah. Ooh, yeah, it certainly is, yeah. Then Van Helsing is asking Mina about this woman in white while Harker continues to just be obtuse about the whole thing.
Bless his little heart.
Mina saw Lucy after she died on the lawn.
Uh-huh.
Why didn't we see this? Why are we being told about this secondhand?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I want to know. Van Helsing promises he'll release Lucy from this horror tonight, but guess what? We never see that either.
Nope.
In fact, the whole Lucy subplot is dropped entirely. More on that later. Mina asks Van Helsing to save her soul like he's going to do with Lucy, and even tells John their love and life is over because he wills it. She knows what's going on with herself.
Right.
I like that she's not duped this whole time. Like Renfield, she has moments of lucidity. John is thick as a brick, though.
Mm-hmm.
The only good version of John Harker on film, I think, is from Horror of Dracula, where he's sent to Castle Dracula by Van Helsing to kill Dracula.
Yeah.
Trevor Eve in the Langella version has a few moments, but we called him Jeff Foxworthy, remember?
Yes.
At least he's not completely oblivious to what's going on around him. And then, of course, there's Keanu. Boy.
Leave him alone.
Doctor!
Stop. We do not know.
Everybody loves Keanu Reeves, but everybody knows he was horribly miscast in that movie.
Leave him alone.
Ted Theodore Logan is John Harker.
Leave Keanu Reeves alone.
Harker wants to take Mina away, but Van Helsing says he has to be allowed to run things his way. But what's the harm in taking her away? Is Van Helsing stealthily using her as bait?
Right.
You know?
You wonder.
He's placed Wolfbane all over, but still, she's in danger there. I hate to say it, but in a moment, I kind of agree with Harker.
Hmm.
Van Helsing calls the nurse Briggs, but the credits on IMDb says she is Grace, English nurse, so... maybe she's Grace Briggs. I don't know. She is played by Josefina Velez, who is in several Spanish language films around this time, but surprisingly, not the Spanish language version of Dracula.
Even though she was there.
Even though, yeah, she could have been on the same sets, yeah. Dracula rises from the coffin in the exact same shot we got earlier.
Uh-huh. Hey, you know, waste not, want not.
Yeah. We then get Van Helsing explaining vampirism again to Seward and Harker. It seems repetitive, but... this is the first U.S. film to treat the supernatural straight and not reveal it's some kind of hoax at the end. So he explains about the stake through the heart and how finding Dracula's boxes of earth and his corpse are the only way to save Mina. Okay, I get that, but couldn't they remove her, go to Carfax Abbey in the morning, and search all day until they find him?
Mm-hmm.
You know. Renfield has the run of the place, so he just wanders in again and comments about what a strange conversation it is for sane people to be having.
Yeah. He's like, you do realize you've crossed into woohoo territory.
Yeah, that's supposed to be my, you know, that's my field right there. Again, Renfield tells us about something that would have been cool to see, but I kind of get that they couldn't pull this off. Dracula appeared under his window, created a red mist on the lawn, then parted it to reveal thousands of rats, as if promising them to Renfield for his cooperation.
Yeah.
That would have been cool to see, but yeah, they couldn't have. They
not
couldn't
at
have,
that time.
No, they couldn't have done that. They probably would have been a field of possums anyway. When they asked what he wanted, he said, "That which has already been done." So it reminds me of the bit in Watchmen when Ozymandias says, "I did it 35 minutes ago." You know, when they're like, "We've got to stop you. I already did it." You know, just basically. Martin informs them Renfield's bars were twisted like cheese, and Van Helsing says, "Dracula's in the house." So did Dracula rip the bars so Renfield could get out and let him into Mina's room?
I don't know.
That's the only thing I can figure Renfield's doing for him, really. The other men run off, but Dracula confronts Van Helsing, and he was actually shown standing inside the large terrace window before, but no one seemed to notice him earlier, which I've always kind of wondered. It's like, why did they show that? Then the two opponents have their biggest face-off. It's only words, so not the physical spectacle of the first Hammer film. But both Van Sloan and Lugosi bring the intensity here. Dracula tells Van Helsing now that he has learned what you have learned. It would be better if he went back home, and Van Helsing says he's going to stay and protect Mina. But Dracula informs him his blood now flows through her veins. I kind of get why we didn't see that in Hollywood at the time, even pre-code.
Right.
Yeah, it's, you know, pretty racy. Van Helsing threatens to tear down Carfax Abbey stone by stone to destroy him, and that's when Dracula has had enough of this guy. He commands him to come to him, and we get those iconic hand gestures Lugosi is known for. It almost works, but Van Helsing snaps out of it.
I know.
Yeah, he's like literally teetering back and forth. Dracula points out his strong will, then moves in, but Van Helsing is packing more than Wolfsbane and produces a crucifix, which sends Dracula running, pulling his cape around him, his face as he runs toward the camera. Van Helsing seems momentarily surprised he survived this.
Yeah.
Which I like.
He's like, oh.
Yeah, it's like, woof. John checks on Mina, and Briggs, the nurse, reports that she grew faint, and when she woke up, Mina was dressed. She greets John and looks like $1 million. Vampirism is good for the complexion, apparently.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I've never felt better in my life. This is the 1930s version of how Mina looked in Horror of Dracula, where director Terrence Fisher told actress Melissa Stribling to look as if you've had the best sex of your life after her night with Dracula.
Oh, well, there you go.
Mina is sizing up John's neck during their pleasant conversation on the terrace. The bat returns, and while John very unconvincingly tries to shoo it away, Mina is answering its squeaks. You know, she's like, I will. Yes, okay, I will. You know,
right.
Mina tells John to get the crucifix away from Van Helsing. She then moves in for the bite, and when Van Helsing pulls it on out to ward her off, we don't see her react to it. We see her father, like, Mina, crying with his hands
right
over his face. I'm not sure why they didn't show her recoil from it. You know, Dracula did earlier.
I know.
So I'm not really sure why they didn't show
that it. That was, you know.
Yeah. Harker still isn't getting it, taking the cross from Van Helsing. Even when Mina reacts to it, and she doesn't react quite as much, and tells him to take it away, he's still not really understanding it.
No!
Dude's adult, man. I'm sorry.
Bless it.
Mina explains that Dracula came to her, opened a vein in his arm, and made me drink. That aspect is often skipped over, although we have seen it, such as Hammer's Dracula, Prince of Darkness, and of course Bram Stoker's Dracula by Coppola.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Martin fires at the bat with a gun, but Van Helsing tells him bullets won't harm that bat. And Martin comments to the maid that they're all crazy except for him and her. And he has his doubts about her. And she agrees, and he slowly backs up.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. Yeah. Dracula appears at Mina's window. He commands Briggs to remove the wolf's bane and open the windows. She puts it away in the hall, and Seward sees her and doesn't question why she's not standing
post. Exactly. I'm like, dude.
She's like, why is she wandering out in the hall when she's supposed to be sitting in there with Mina? Dracula comes in, and the hallway door is open, and he takes her. I mean, the hallway door is open, and they're standing right outside.
Yeah.
I mean, again, he's ballsy, and they are stupid. I mean, it's just... We then see Renfield creeping around the Abbey exteriors, and John and Van Helsing watching him from an iron gate. You can't tell it from this version, but they are outside the cemetery, having just staked Lucy.
Yes.
While we don't see the action in the Spanish version, there's a few minutes of explanation with them both warily walking through the fog toward the front of the cemetery gate, having just done the deed. Here it just seems like they are at the gate of the Abbey. Mm-hmm. So Lucy's story is completely unresolved without prior knowledge of the Dracula story or seeing the Spanish version. I didn't remember that was like, but watching it with a critical eye, I'm like, oh yeah, they totally just dropped that.
Yeah.
And the Lucy scene is always a standout, like, you know, from Hammer to Langella, like you said, and to Coppola, of course.
Right.
With all the blood vomit, you know, and everything. I get that they couldn't show her being staked, but it's a shame that they just left it out completely.
I know.
Yeah. I guess Dracula called Renfield because he says, I'm here, master. Repeatedly when he meets him and the entranced Mina on the impressive Abbey staircase. Probably to maybe move their boxes or guard them from Van Helsing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, Van Helsing and Harker follow, and he yells for Mina. Renfield quickly goes into, I didn't know, I swear, you know.
Oh, yeah.
As they followed him. Dracula isn't buying it. Renfield starts to run, but Dracula commands him to stay, and Dracula slowly, very menacingly, descends the stairs toward him as Renfield begs him to let him live. He can't die with innocent blood on his hands. And this is really sad. I mean, the real Renfield is in there and really doesn't want to die a murderous madman.
No.
Dracula grabs him by the throat and picks him up as he screams. Apparently, the screams were edited out of the 1936 re-release, but were added back in the last 30 years or so.
Hmm.
So, and there's another sound bite that's going to be edited out here in a minute. As Harker and Van Helsing try to break in, poor Renfield's lifeless body tumbles down the stairs and he falls. Doesn't even make it to the bottom of the stairs. He falls off of one of the higher parts at the bottom behind some debris. And it's a very tragic end to a guy who was just doing his job in the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, bless his little heart.
Yeah. Dracula carries Mina off into the crypt as Van Helsing and Harker race after them. He locks the door, but they eventually knock it down. Van Helsing noting that they have him trapped since the sun is rising. Dracula shouldn't have tried to have done all this in one night.
Exactly. You know, split it up into shifts, man.
Yeah, if there's one thing movies have taught us, vampires have no sense of time. They are always running right up until dawn. You know, plan your evenings better, guys.
Yeah.
If you're not werewolves, you can come out every night. You know?
Yeah.
You know, have Mina drink your blood one night, come back and get her the next night. Don't try to do it all at one time. You know, I know you're horny, but come on. They hear Mina scream, thinking that he may have killed her. They make it into the crypt, and they eventually find two crates. They open one and see Dracula, but Van Helsing only slightly opens the second, and they just assume Mina is in there. Why not check to be sure?
No.
Van Helsing tells him to get a piece of stone to help me drive the stake through the hearts. So they think Mina is fully vampirized. You'd better double check, dude.
I know, right? He's going to kill her.
Yeah. Harker brings him back a piece of iron, like maybe the joints of an old door, and Van Helsing has made a stake from the wood of Dracula's own box. I like that bit.
I do too.
The lid and just like broke it up and made a stake. But he's going to stake Mina first, which don't ever do that. That's what happened to Van Helsing in the Hammer movie. He staked the woman first, and then Dracula had time to get out, you know. But then he opens the box and sees that she isn't there. So now he checks. When John searches for her, Van Helsing stakes Dracula, but if you look closely, you can see that Edward Van Sloan puts the stake to the side of Lugosi's left shoulder, then blocks his body while he starts pounding. We hear his groans as John turns around, but those were also cut from the 1936 re-release.
Yes.
Mina convulses as Dracula dies, and her screams draw John over to her. She tells them the daylight stopped Dracula from killing her. Again, watch that clock, dude.
I know.
You know? Could have just, you know, taking care of it, like, at 7 o'clock the next night, you'd been fine. Van Helsing tells them Dracula is dead forever. Yeah, right. He tells them to go, but he won't be joining them, not presently. So why is he sticking around? To make sure there aren't any other vampires? To decapitate him and burn both parts of the body? To make sure the two lovers get to walk away to church bells alone?
I know, right? It's an aesthetic.
Yeah. Cleansed from the evil influence, now Mina can walk into the light in the presence of God, very in keeping with the morals of the time. You know?
Yeah.
So what's your take having watched this with an eye for podcast discussion?
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, I caught that about the wine being a very old vintage, and then where she is descending from the Carfax Abbey basement, for lack of a better term, up the stairs, she's going back into the light. It was, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but what did you think, you know, of the film overall, watching it again for a podcast?
I mean, it was good. Lugosi is fabulous in the role. You have actors like Harker who are just kind of like, meh. You know, Renfield is fabulous. It's one of those cases. Is it the first version of Dracula that you see? Yes. You know, most people are familiar with.
Yeah.
Is it your first thought of Dracula? But as you realize it, as you're going through, a lot of the things that you really, or that I really like about vampires are not necessarily from this film. They're things that have been added on to later.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I was able to appreciate the really great aspects of it better this time compared to many other Universal films. I've been down on it a bit despite fully acknowledging its importance. The best part of it is still, hands down, Lugosi's.
That's exactly what I said.
Fully committed performance. Yeah, I totally agree. Second would be Dwight Frye's wonderful take on Renfield, which I actually found quite moving this time around. Van Sloan is solid as Van Helsing as well. Of course, I'm Peter Cushing guy. But he brings old world wisdom and strength to the proceedings. He's very good in it.
And thick bottleneck glasses.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Is it weird that Edward Van Sloan as Van Helsing looks a lot like Joe Walsh from the Hell Freezes Over concert? Think about it. He kind of does. From the Eagles. It kind of reminds me of him.
Okay.
Imagine him singing Pretty Maids All in a Row. I do think it seems like everyone is moving in and out of the same rooms over and over again toward the end of the movie. The back end seems a bit rushed, such as brushing over the Lucy subplot. The kinetic energy of the early part of the movie kind of halts as it does turn into a film version of the play. The Spanish version keeps things a little more interesting visually. Mm-hmm. But without this film, we probably wouldn't even be doing this podcast.
Right.
Despite its shortcomings in some areas compared to the films that immediately follow it, like the nearly perfect Frankenstein, it is the foundation for both Universal horror films and horror cinema in general. Despite not being treated very well by Hollywood, Lugosi's indelible performance still resonates.
Yes.
The look in his accent and mannerisms are still baked into the public consciousness as what a vampire looks and sounds like. Walk into any store today and you'll see a vampire with a tuxedo, opera cape, and a widow's peak hairdo.
Yep.
Despite being a more of a Christopher Lee guy, I will never deny Lugosi's masterful performance. It's a shame he only got to truly reprise the role once in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, but he's great in that too. He was supposed to return for Dracula's Daughter in 1936, but while he was paid for the role, and much more than he was paid for this film, there's only a dummy of him on hand. For perhaps his best take on a similar character in any other vampire films, I can't recommend enough Columbia's Return of the Vampire, which we covered years ago on House Frankenstein. If you haven't seen Dracula in a while, it's streaming on Amazon Prime, along with several other Universal classics. Well worth the watch for Lugosi and a side of fry.
Oh my.
We'll take a quick break and then one last trip to the Comic Crypt for 2023.
Oh.
A spine-tingling, nerve-shattering podcast featuring all your favorite monsters. You won't believe your ears when you listen to Monster Kid Radio. Here are your hosts, Derek M. Cook, and his ever-rotating stable of guests discuss your favorite classic and sometimes not-so-classic monster movies. Subscribe to Monster Kid Radio through iTunes or Stitcher, or visit MonsterKidRadio.net before the next weekly episode of Monster Kid Radio. Go through the archives for interviews with Sarah Karloff, Victoria Price, and Joel Hodgson. Listen to discussions about movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Island of Terror, and King Kong. And don't forget convention coverage from Monster Bash and the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. Classic Monsters, Modern Talk, and the Head of Rondo Hatton. Only on Monster Kid Radio.
In 2011, the Irredeemable Shag and Aqua Rob Kelly teamed up to create the Fire & Water Podcast. In 2016, they teamed up with Ryan Daly, The Franklins, and Siskoid to form the Fire & Water Podcast Network. A network built on teaming up needs a show about team-ups.
Marvel Team-Up?
Yes.
The Brave and the Bold?
You know it.
Marvel 2-in-1.
It's clobbering time.
DC Comics presents.
Of course.
Supervillain Team-Up?
Good idea.
Youngblood X-Force?
Technically.
FW Team Up, coming this summer, only from the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
No place to hide, no place to run, no place to run. The mutant hate has now begun.
Like thunder.
Okay, we're back, and thanks to our pal network all-star Siskoid, we have a Bronze Age treasure to discuss. X-Men Annual No. 6 from 1982, on sale July 27th, 1982. On this cover by Bill Sienkiewicz, a vampire-ized Storm holds the unconscious and bitten body of Kitty Pryde. Colossus, Nightcrawler, Wolverine, and Cyclops lay defeated at her feet, while Dracula smiles against the blood-red background. So what do you think of the cover?
It's very dynamic, and I'm digging Storm's outfit. That's cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Yeah, I like the fabric and, the fabric work and, I'm not trying to be pervy, but the way he drew the fabric around her breast, it like looks like real, like how somebody would actually look.
Yeah.
And she's got like realistic breasts, they're not like, soccer balls glued to her chest.
Exactly.
good on him. Yeah. It's very stylized, more than the art inside, but nowhere near where Sienkiewicz will go in the next few years with his art. It's very evocative, but I think it's ultimately easier to read than the previous Dracula versus X-Men cover in Uncanny number 159, which, remember, we were kind of like her shadow and then her face in the background.
Right.
It was cool, but it's kind of hard to read what the shadow was. The story is called Blood Feud. Chris Claremont was the writer, Bill Sienkiewicz the penciler, Bob Wycheck the inker, Tom Orzechowski was the letterer, Glennis Wing the colorist, and Tom DeFalco was the editor.
Professor Rachel Van Helsing returns home from her class at Bard University to find her old and supposedly destroyed foe, Dracula, waiting for her. Meanwhile, at Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters, an anguished Kitty Pryde lashes out at her X-Men teammates over the divorce of her parents. While Kitty cries in her room, a strange female shadow appears on her wall.
Storm awakens from a dream where she once again succumbed to Dracula's control and attacked her friends. Checking on Kitty, she realizes it was just a dream, but also a summons from the Prince of Darkness. Hoping to protect her teammates, she flies off to meet the Lord of Vampires. Kitty watches her leave and seeks the help of Peter Rasputin, aka Colossus. Behind closed doors, she uncharacteristically does something to him.
Mm-hmm. Storm flies to England in a manor on the coastal cliffs of Cornwall. There, Dracula and his new acolyte, Rachel Van Helsing, await her. Storm reminds him that he promised to leave her and the X-Men alone after their last encounter. But Dracula says he has need of her, and when she dies, she will be his anyway. He gives his word that he will not harm her friends or any innocents if she helps him. He sends her to the English town of Pindaro, a stronghold whose magical energies repel evil like vampires. There rests a book containing the Montesi formula, an incantation that can obliterate vampires for all time. Rachel had secured the book there, and Dracula wants it. He sends Storm in, but she is opposed by a crossbow-wielding Kitty and Colossus. Kitty retrieves the book for herself, and an injured Storm barely escapes, saved from death by Dracula.
She relives the death of her parents and her own traumatizing time trapped under the rubble of the battle which killed them. She awakens in a coffin, but learns Dracula had not turned her into the undead yet. Dracula moves in to bite her and complete her transformation, hoping to have a superpowered vampire to oppose Kitty and the Montesi formula. Cyclops, Wolverine, and Nightcrawler arrive and stop Dracula, engaging in battle with him and Rachel. Nightcrawler stakes Dracula, but Rachel removes it, and the vampire escapes into the manor's catacombs.
Kitty and Colossus arrive and join the fight, and the other X-Men are confused by their behavior. The heroes follow Dracula into the catacombs, but the undead fiend manages to bite Wolverine and turn him into his slave. During the melee, Kitty begins reading the formula and Dracula begins to disintegrate, but she is interrupted by Nightcrawler, who recognizes the incantation as coming from the evil book, The Darkhold. Dracula survives, but his hold on everyone weakens.
Kitty reveals that she is really a vampire possessing the girl's body. Dracula recognizes his foe, but the X-Men do not. While distracted, Rachel gains her composure long enough to stake Dracula, and creating a cross from candlesticks, turns his body to bones. Wolverine moves in to decapitate him, but the storm outside causes the manor and the mountainside to collapse. The X-Men barely escape, unable to finish the job in destroying Dracula.
Rachel asks to be released from her tortured existence, and Wolverine volunteers, bringing her in for an embrace and staking her through the heart. She watches the sun rise and begins to disintegrate. Kitty reveals herself as Lilith, Dracula's vengeful daughter, who planned all of this to destroy her father. She leaves Kitty and tells the X-Men they are free from Dracula's curse for good. But Storm wonders, is it over really?
Yeah, so we covered X-Men number 159 last year, which was released in April of 1982, so readers just had to wait a few months for the sequel. by the exact same creative team. So yes. That's cool. Rachel Van Helsing was one of the heroes of Marvel's Tomb of Dracula series, which ran from April 1972 to August 1979. She debuted in issue number 3, created by Archie Goodwin and Gene Colan, but was primarily written by Marv Wolfman, who took over the series with issue number 7. Dracula was seemingly destroyed at the end of Tomb of Dracula number 70, but it's Dracula, so of course he wasn't. Rachel was a very strong character in Tomb of Dracula, and given Chris Claremont was known as a strong writer of female characters, it's odd that he would just have Rachel walk in, be taken by surprise by Dracula, and become his slave. It's not quite fridging, but it kind of circles that.
Yeah.
As someone who read Tomb of Dracula, this seems very cavalier to me. Checking in with the X-Men, Kitty is very upset to get a letter that her parents are getting a divorce. This was the type of real-life elements that made fans love this series at the time. There's an odd bit in the bottom of page 4. The close-up of Kitty is actually just an enlarged stat of the previous panel. So did Sienkiewicz intend this, or did he draw something different that someone didn't like, and so they statted it in, blown up?
I know. I was wondering that as well.
It's very obvious, you know, that it's like the ink lines are huge, and, you know, just it's obvious that they just blew it up. The top panel on page 6 has Kitty telling her parents, her absent parents, "I hate you!" There's a red surprint of the same image of her face, slightly enlarged, printed over her. It's meant to show rage, but in an X-Men book, it looks like she's already possessed by something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's like she's got the Phoenix Force or something. We see what we later learn is Lilith's shadow. Then on the next page, it cuts to midnight, and Kitty wakes up, and being an 80s comic, we read her thoughts in word balloons, but later we'll learn this is Storm's dream, so...
How does that work out?
Yeah, how does Storm know what Kitty's thinking?
Right.
Storm putting the bite on Kitty, then discarding her, is pretty shocking. The large panel of a possibly dead Kitty laying in the floor, her innocence lost with her toys strung about, is pretty powerful, too. As are the panels of the following page, where Storm takes out all the X-Men. But shouldn't Scott sleep with his ruby quartz visor or glasses on?
You would think.
I mean, if he wakes up in the night, he's going to blow a hole in the ceiling and kill whoever's up above him.
At least a little sleep mask.
Yeah, exactly. Ruby quartz sleep mask. There you go. Claremont caption reads, granting each a moment of extreme ecstasy before casting them into eternal oblivion. So they died happy, at least.
I mean, it's like, well.
Yeah. Interestingly, in her dream, Storm turns into a humanoid bat creature, but she has a man's chest and nothing covering her. It's the she-bat rule.
So
she lands before Dracula returns to humanoid form and the two start to make out. Then she wakes up. We do learn that Storm sleeps in the nude, so the commando season of House of Frankenstein continues.
Yes. Buck naked with a cheese sandwich.
Yeah. Will these super team members ever learn? If Dracula's messing with you, bring your teammates. Heck, call in the Defenders so you can get Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
I mean, don't go alone. That's just dumb. Kitty sees Storm leave and has thought balloons that are pretty un-Kitty-like. She goes to see Peter, a.k.a. Colossus, and behind closed doors apparently puts the bite on him. The two had a romantic thing despite their age gap and Kitty being a minor. It doesn't read very well now.
No, it does not.
Yeah. So Storm goes to see Dracula, meets Rachel, and learns that while he let her out of his immediate control, when and if she dies, she belongs to him. That's some Faustian shit right there, man.
I mean, that's a deal.
Yeah. Woof. He mentally opens her old bite wounds and she bleeds, becoming weak. I'm not sure the weird dots around her face sell her disorientation, though.
No, I'm just like...
Did that kind of throw you off?
Yes.
Yeah. Dracula wants the Montesi formula, but apparently it is in the Darkhold book. Nightcrawler points this out, but Dracula never calls it by name. Steve Gerber created the Montesi formula for the black and white magazine Dracula Lives, number 3. Storm is dressed in a dark green bodysuit and a yellow utility belt when she breaks into the Pendero estate. Aurora, agent of Drac.
I'm sorry, but when I saw it, you know, it was just dark. And it looked like she had got into Black Widow's closet there.
Yeah.
I was like.
Kind of did, yeah. Kitty shoots her in the shoulder with a crossbow bolt, then retrieves the book. Storm encases Colossus in a block of ice, but security arrives, and she must leap from a window. She's too weak to keep her wind power up to fly, and she actually thinks maybe it's better to die than be Dracula's slave, but he swoops in and grabs her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Storm wakes up in Cairo in a gown and scarf marked with Dracula's symbol. Although she appears as an adult, she's reliving a childhood memory with her parents moments before an aerial assault takes their lives. Her parents are killed and she's trapped in rubble, hence her extreme claustrophobia that even made it into the 90s animated series.
I almost thought that it was like, you know, maybe you know, she talks about that her, Storm talks about how her victims are given a moment of extreme ecstasy. I almost wonder if that was Storm's moment of extreme ecstasy being with her parents again before she devolved into, you know, reality and then, you know, it went through.
That could be. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Dracula actually apologizes for triggering her claustrophobia by placing her in a coffin. Do you think he's being sincere or did he do that on purpose?
I don't know.
Yeah, I couldn't really tell either. There's a certain nobility to the Marvel Dracula, but it's very hit or miss.
Yeah.
You know. She attacks him and he tosses her around. Rachel tells her that there are worse fates. You do not understand. He offers rapture and power beyond comprehension. But as she says this, she appears very sad. Not sure if this was in the script or Sienkiewicz just felt it needed that. I noticed that, the look on her face. He grabs Storm by her hair and is about to put the bite on her. It's kind of odd to see her in damsel in distress
mode. I know. I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah.
You know I'm not.
Yeah. The X-Men enter and Nightcrawler manages to stake Dracula, but of course, he's not out just yet as Rachel pulls the stake out. Kitty and Colossus show up, and Rachel pounces on Cyclops and becomes a werewolf, but he blasts her off. I feel like this issue may have been slightly rushed. Colossus follows Dracula, and a huge weight drops on him. Cyclops blasts it, but it's very roughly rendered.
Yes.
There's also pretty sparse backgrounds throughout this issue, I noticed. Cyclops explains that they tracked the Blackbird jet Kitty stole and then investigated the robbery at Pendarrow, and Wolverine tracked them there. You know, it works for me.
Why not?
Yeah. Cyclops tells Nightcrawler to take Storm out of there, but she reminds him she's team leader now, and she decides to stay.
Like, dude, no.
Yeah, this is my fight, and I'm staying. Cyclops blasts through the floor so they can follow Drac into the catacombs. I was shocked to see Dracula actually bite Wolverine. I think they later did a what-if where he became Lord of the Vampires. It probably keyed off this moment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I can't imagine, you know, nowadays Wolverine would get bitten by Dracula like that, you know. It's kind of like the Bat God thing. It's the Wolverine God thing, right? You know. Yeah. Rachel and Storm fight, but since Dracula is distracted by his own battles, his hold on her fades and she begs Storm to kill her, but she says she can't. Kitty starts to read the Montesi formula, but Nightcrawler interrupts her. Let her finish, dude. Just let her finish it.
But, like he says, you know, if she reads the whole incantation, then she is lost.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to mess with that Darkhold. It gives you that weird third eye and all that crap.
Yeah.
So they realize, didn't do much good for Wanda in the MCU, that's for sure. They realize Kitty is indeed possessed and Dracula knows who it is. She changes to Lilith, but the X-Men don't know who that is.
Yeah.
So she has to explain later. A lot of people probably didn't know who that was. Dracula smacks her and is monologuing when Rachel throws a spear right through him.
I know.
She pulls a Peter Cushing and makes a cross out of candlesticks like a good Van Helsing should.
That's right.
Of course, the place starts to crumble because they don't want Dracula completely destroyed.
But they set it up where, you know, they actually set this up because they said, you know, Storm's like, hey, it's tied. The weather's tied to my mood. Da da da. All this is going on, so they tied it together.
Yeah, they did. They I guess they did. I guess I kind of glossed over that to a point. I guess you're right. It's in there. So that they don't get to completely destroy Dracula. So where's Captain America when you need him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The chunk.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, here in a minute, we'll get back to that. Storm is willing to help Rachel end her tortured existence, but Wolverine steps up. Killing's my profession, bub. No, you didn't say bub. But, yeah. So, how do you feel about how Wolverine dispatched Rachel? They used the same sound effect as Cap's shield in the Baron Blood.
Yeah.
Chuck. So, how'd you feel about that?
I mean, poor man. I mean, he later has to end up killing, you know, Jean Grey and, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, poor guy.
At least in the movies, anyway. Yeah. She turns into a skeleton, but would she? I mean, she's only been dead a few days.
True.
But maybe the sun, I guess.
Yeah.
Then we get the info dump about Lilith, but if you don't know her history, you're kind of lost on how she can survive in sunlight and why she hates her father and so on. So she was born to Dracula and his wife, Zofia, before Dracula became a vampire. Dracula was forced to marry Zofia by his father. When his father died, he cast him out and they lived as peasants. Zofia killed herself rather than live this way, and Lilith was raised by a peasant woman named Gretchen. When Dracula became a vampire, he killed her son. So Gretchen used her Roma magic to turn Lilith into a vampire that didn't have the weaknesses of the species in order to bedevil and then destroy her father.
Oh.
Yeah. She leaked word of the formula. She tells the X-Men she leaked word of the formula. So I guess she's the reason Dracula found Rachel and vampirized her. She just took over Kitty to enter Pendaro, which even she couldn't enter, and draw in the X-Men. She fanged, I like to use that word, she fanged Colossus because she knew she couldn't control the whole team.
Right.
She conveniently tells them Kitty will be fine, and with Dracula destroyed, Storm and Wolverine are free for being his slaves when they die. Of course, Storm isn't really sure as her and Wolverine look at the rising sun. So what did you think of this one?
I mean, I actually liked it. I mean, you know, there's some things like we talked about throughout there, but I liked it overall.
There's 12 issues of a modern comic packed in here, but it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, despite her being the one who kills Dracula, I still dislike it when creators take characters off the board in such a trivial way, especially if they have no connection to them.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like Rachel Van Helsing deserved better than this.
And still had more stories to tell.
Yeah. There's a lot of captions and dialogue, but Claremont was wordy even for the time. Still, you know what the characters are feeling, and you do care about them, so it's very well done.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the art is a bit rushed in spots, but it does look nice. Sienkiewicz is still in his proto-Neil Adams type phase, but he'll soon evolve into his more famous avant-garde style, especially on the X-Men spinoff, The New Mutants. A year later, in Doctor Strange Volume 2, Number 62, Roger Stern and Steve Lealoa have Strange use the Montesi formula to destroy all vampires. Lilith feels her father die and is happy, then she dies herself.
Oh, wonder why.
Yeah, Marvel apparently was done with monsters at the time. Of course, eventually they all come back. Well, she didn't want to be a vampire either, but she just really wanted to get her father first. So.
Well, I know, but, you know, she apparently had, you know, she had been made a vampire without, you know, their weaknesses. So, I mean, I understand all vampire, you know.
But the Montessa formula apparently is going to take her out too, so. Yeah, but yeah, for whatever reason, I think it might have been a Jim Shooter thing. They wanted to distance themselves from the monsters at that time. But, you know, like 5 or 6 years later, they were back. So, yeah. Well, that'll wrap things up for this episode and the House of Frankenstein series for 2023. A huge shout out, as always, to our friend Terry O'Malley, a.k.a. Ward Hill Terry, or Ward Hills Have Eyes Terry, for the House of Frankenstein theme. Follow Terry's band Stop Calling Me Frank on their Facebook page. Check the show notes for more info.
Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, visit patreon.com/FWPodcast.
Extra special thanks to Jorge Luis Castillo, Matt Ryan, Neil Whitney, Jeff Owens of the Classic Horrors Club Podcast, David Capoon, and Rocket Dan Johnson, who specifically support our JLU cast. We'll be thanking you guys over there when we return to JLU cast. Could you guys help us take the Halloween decorations down? It should only take a week or so.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, before we leave, I want to mention, we asked our patrons, who is your favorite Universal monster? We ran a poll a few weeks back, right before House of Frankenstein began. And here are the results. The number one monster for our patrons was Frankenstein's monster, played by Boris Karloff. He got 33%. The Wolfman, Lon Chaney Jr., 19%. Dracula, Bela Lugosi, 17%, so not bad. There was a tie for the Creature from the Black Lagoon and the Bride of Frankenstein. They both got 11%. And a three-way tie with the Mummy, Imhotep, Karloff, the Mummy, Karras, Chaney Jr., and the Invisible Man, Claude Rains. They all got 3%. So that's the breakdown, and other monsters just didn't apparently have enough, you know, they weren't popular enough to get on the board. But
yeah.
So there you go. So the Frankenstein monster won, and I'm happy to see that the Wolfman came in second. So,
yeah.
Because he's my favorite. Thanks to everyone who listened, shared our post, and especially those who took the time to leave comments on fireandwaterpodcast.com. We really enjoyed reading your comments. Thanks, everybody who's listened over the past, you know, 10 seasons of House of Frankenstein. It's a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun with it. But it is a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun, too. It's our favorite time of year, you know,
yeah.
So we enjoy it. We should be back at JLUcast sometime next month. Until then, have a safe and happy Halloween.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide, who is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders, and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at spireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FWPodcast.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geekcast.
He came and stood below my window in the moonlight. And he promised me things. Not in words, but by doing them.
Doing them?
By making them happen. A red mist spread over the lawn, coming on like a flame of fire. And then he parted it. And I could see that there were thousands of rats with their eyes blazing red, like his, only smaller. And then he held up his hand. And they all stopped. And I thought he seemed to be saying, rats, 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 thousands, millions of them, all red blood. All these will I give you if you will obey me.